Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, friends. Thanks for joining a podcast. I want to tell you about something really new and exciting called Patreon.com/BP Show. It's a great way to get exclusive interviews with newsmakers, voicemails, personalized videos, political commentary, and early access to a special podcast called The Making of Bernie Sanders. Go to Patreon.com/BP Show. Patreon.com/BP Show.
On your radio, on TV, and online, this is The Bill Press Show.
Good morning and welcome to The Bill Press Show. I'm Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter at The Guardian, filling in for Bill on this Thursday morning, the end of a tragic week. Here in the United States, we will be following the latest from Las Vegas, the fallout from the mass shooting, what we know and have learned over the last 24 hours about the gunman whose girlfriend has broken her silence. President Trump, of course, was on the ground yesterday and tweeting bright and early this morning. So wonderful to be in Las Vegas yesterday and meet with people from police to doctors to the victims themselves, who I will never forget. He then, less than all 15 minutes later, switched gears and asked, why isn't the Senate Intel Committee looking into the fake news networks in our country to see why so much of our news is just made up, in all caps, fake? Jamie Benson, our reliable producer, I'm sure is used to many a Trump tweet. That too, first thing in the morning.
We try not to read too many of them on air. But when he tweets at the beginning of our show, he sort of sets the table for us, and we have to address these. You know, Sabrina, I will say yesterday, the first tweet that we read that you read about his trip to Las Vegas, I will give him this. Yesterday, he was pretty good as far as staying on script, keeping to prepared remarks, being clear about we're not going to be intimidated by an act of violence, an act of evil like this.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one day. It's one day out of the Trump administration. The day before, he went to Puerto Rico and told them that they threw our budget out of whack.
Right.
Though they had just gone through a natural disaster.
He tossed paper towels to people in Puerto Rico who have been struggling without water, without food, without medicine.
He played Papa Shot with toilet paper.
Right, which is an image that will, in the archive of images we've already been given in the under this fairly young presidency, I think, stand the test of time. Quick update, since we're talking about Las Vegas. The girlfriend of Las Vegas gunman Stephen Paddock has spoken out. Her name, of course, is Mary Lou Danley. And she was out of the country at the time of the shooting, initially with some confusion over whether or not she has played a role in any way. Was she aware of what her partner was about to do, about the horror that he, or terror, I should say, that he was about to inflict on concertgoers? Of course, we know that there are 58 people who were shot dead. There are many more still in the hospital in critical condition. You'll have to remember that more than 500 people were injured and after the gunman opened fire. So Mary Lou Danley has said through a lawyer that she never heard anything that would have suggested he was about to inflict any sort of violence. In a statement, she said, "I loved him and hoped for a quiet future together."
She called him a kind, caring, quiet man.
As Jamie has just said. And she also, I think, in some ways, of course, this is all through her lawyer, reinforced the notion that Stephen Paddock, the gunman, may have been living a secret life. That is what police had suggested hours before she issued her statement, just to kind of bring people up to speed on what the latest is. Police found explosives, more explosives, I should say, in Paddock's car at the Mandalay Bay Hotel, where he had, of course, rented out a suite, along with 1,600 rounds of ammunition. He had been gambling just hours before he began shooting. He booked an apartment at a high-rise, Ogden, in downtown Las Vegas, a week earlier. And it is obviously not clear still what the motive is. There has been no real indication as to why this man would suddenly, with no criminal record and no documented, I think, cases of violence, suddenly inflict this sort of terror upon all of these
people. You know, there are clues that are popping up available to the public. I had read a dispatch from the LA Times a couple of days ago interviewing Starbucks employees where Stephen Paddock and Mary Lou Danley would go every morning to get the same drink. And the Starbucks employees had said that Paddock was basically insulting and borderline abusive to Mary Lou Danley. You know, Mary Lou Danley obviously is going through a lot right now. Supposedly, Paddock wired $100,000 to her and her family in the Philippines, sent her on this trip. She said, you know, she felt a little suspicious that he had sent her back to her home country and had reportedly had said that the money was for her family to buy a home. But, you know, if I'm Mary Lou Danley in this situation, she probably is trying to save herself and save her family as much as possible. At this point, if I were her, I'd be as transparent as possible. But I don't know if she has the ability to do that, because it certainly seems that Stephen Paddock was not a kind, quiet, caring man. He may have been a quiet man, but he was most likely a sick, demented, twisted man on the inside.
And she, as you noted, was somewhat suspect about him wiring her $100,000. He had surprised her with a cheap ticket to visit her family just over 2 weeks ago. And he said that that money was to buy a house. And so what she said in her statement was, "I was grateful, but honestly, I was worried it was a way for him to break up with me. It never occurred to me in any way whatsoever that he was planning violence against anyone." We will be, of course, learning a lot more about the shooting in the coming days, weeks, months. We will keep on breaking it down here on this show. But we also will talk about the ensuing debate over gun control that predictably has cropped up again, and I think even more predictably already faces an uphill battle. I am going to switch gears for a moment, because we just have been joined in studio by Peter Ogburn.
Hello,
himself.
Serena. How are you?
Good.
It's been a morning, Peter,
you?
Huh?
It's been
a morning.
A morning. We have been in this studio for, Christ, 10 years, 11, 12 years now.
Yep.
And this is the first time that I've actually been late because of a traffic incident. There was a traffic incident. Yeah.
So I know that there was a traffic incident, but I can't believe that this is the first
time. No, it was horrible. It was horrible this
morning. Well, you should have left an hour earlier, damn it.
I guess I should have. That's the lesson that I've learned now.
Yeah. Just coasting now.
And, of course, we're also dealing with the internet provider that is not even fit to provide internet service to a third world country. I'm not going to name the company, but it rhymes with Schmamschmast.
Oh, boy.
Honestly,
you're listening to us, hopefully, on the TuneIn app, but you cannot actually see us.
Probably the worst company in America. Probably the worst company in America. Like, if if I was as bad at doing my job as they are at doing their job, I'd probably still be in prison. Like, it's insane that they get away with not providing service for people who pay for it. But look.
This is kind of like the equivalent of a morning Trump Twitter rant.
Yeah,
but warranted.
Sad.
Sad.
Sad what Comcast is able to get away with. But look.
The failing Comcast.
I'm not going to get upset about it. I've got a bum ticker. I got to behave. I got to not get all worked up. It's nice to see you.
It's so nice to see you.
For those of you that are listening.
I have not seen here in this studio, Peter, a couple months, I would say, probably.
It's been 5 weeks.
5 weeks since
my heart exploded. Right. We'll put it that way.
Yes. And so whatever the time was before that I hosted.
Yeah.
Was the last time you and I were sitting here together.
Yeah.
And it gives me great joy to see you here, where you belong.
I feel great.
Back where you belong.
This is my first week back, and I should have expected that something this horrible would have happened in my first week back. That I would be late, and that we wouldn't have internet service.
And that we wouldn't have internet service.
Well, you know, he said to me, I'll be there as soon as I can. Don't worry. I said, you know what? I've done this without you plenty of times. I think we'll be just fine.
Jamie's handled this a couple of times.
And, of course, then I jinx myself because when I get here, the internet goes out.
Famous last words, Jamie.
It's been a morning.
Who's wearing a Boston Red Sox jersey?
Playoffs, baby.
I can't.
Game one.
I'm not going to
Red Sox Astros this afternoon.
I will comment on it.
Sure?
Yeah, no,
it's a football game tonight, too.
You have to...
Oh, are they going to win this week?
I don't know, actually.
Who are they playing? I was going to say, it doesn't really matter who they're playing because they lost to one of the most garbage teams in the NFL last week.
The New England Patriots are playing the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Oh, Jameis Winston. Mr. Crab Legs himself.
They'll lose that game.
They might.
Right. Peter.
Hi, Sabrina.
Hi. So, you know, I have to talk to you about Las Vegas because...
Oh, my God.
You and I have sat here... Over the last few years, since I've been fortunate enough to be filling in for Bill, and we've talked about this so many times before, I just thought back to the entire show that we did after the shooting in San Bernardino.
Yeah,
I recall the other shooting in California. Targeted toward women.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I'm actually forgetting exactly.
Yeah, I forgot the guy's name, but he was a guy who had like a real problem with women.
Right, he was a misogynist.
He ended up killing all men, but he put out a manifesto about how women aren't paying enough attention to me, and therefore I have the a blank slate to go kill people.
We did a whole show around that. We did a whole show Santa Barbara. That was Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara.
We did a whole show around Pulse. That was in Orlando. We've just seen this show over and over and over again to the point that I'm almost out of things to say because we already know how this is going to play out.
Yeah.
We saw the thoughts and prayers that were tweeted or put out in statements from Republicans. We saw Democrats call for stricter gun laws and say now is the time to act. We now have a president who is not going to use the bully pulpit or embrace gun control any time in the foreseeable future. So he suggested just while he was on the ground yesterday in Las Vegas saying that's a conversation for a later time, as opposed to Obama, who dedicated much of his second term, at least, to unsuccessfully and very forcefully repeatedly calling for background checks and other measures.
Look, we live in hell. This country is hell.
Right.
This is crazy that we allow this to happen. And we are the only nation that allows this to happen. I don't often give a ton of praise to Chuck Todd, but yesterday on his Meet the Press Daily.
Don't do it.
I know. I have to, though. No, he was absolutely right. That like newscasters, pundits, anybody who follows the news needs to take this approach. That, like, he said, after the financial collapse, did we say, well, now's not the time to talk about financial regulations? No, everybody got on board and said, we cannot allow this to happen again. Like, when these things happen, we have politicians who we've elected to make things happen, to make things better. I don't, for the life of me,
right,
understand why we as a nation can't find some common ground. And like, look, I'm extreme. I'm the person who says, go out, take everybody's guns. No one can have a gun. I don't care. Get rid of all guns. I'm a rubberneck that way. I don't care. I don't want any guns.
Right.
I don't need a gun. You don't need a gun. You want to go hunting, learn how to shoot a bow, whatever.
You're just trying to get on Hannity again.
Bring it. Bring it.
Well, you know, I mean,
but like,
you can't go anywhere. You can't go to school. You can't go to church.
No.
You can't go to college. You can't go to the movie theater. You can't go to the office. You can't go to your holiday party. You can't go to a concert.
Right. Well, we had like,
where can you go? I mean, I think it was Trevor Noah who, on the night of, on Monday, as we were, you know, we had spent the day waking up to the news and you had a lot of monologues. You know, Jimmy Kimmel had a very forceful one too. But Trevor Noah, you know, he said when, and this is sort of to the point that you were just making, when a plane crashes, you talk about plane safety.
Sure.
When a bridge collapses, talk about infrastructure. Why is it that this is the only case where anytime there's an incident, and there are so many more incidents, there are daily, not just these mass shootings that we talk about, you know, daily rates of gun violence that are unparalleled because there isn't even daily gun violence in most countries to begin with, certainly not in the developed world.
No.
We don't talk about guns.
No. You know, look.
Or gun safety.
Look, when we had cars, right?
Right.
Cars started rolling out onto the highways. People started driving. People started getting in accidents, which are inevitable.
Yeah.
We didn't have seatbelts, right?
Right.
People were dying at an alarming rate. I'd tell you the numbers, but I don't have internet because Comcast is the worst. But people were dying at an alarming rate because we didn't have seatbelts in our cars. And then we go, ding.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do something to help people and prevent people from dying every time there's a fender bender. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like we can do this. This guy who had 42 guns.
At least something like that.
42 guns. You don't need 42 guns. You don't need 32 guns. You don't need 22 guns. You don't need 12 guns. You don't need 5 guns. You want a rifle to go hunting? Okay.
He bought most of these guns within the last 1 year.
Yeah.
So in addition to the fact that he doesn't even, you know, need the type of guns that he bought for anything other than mass murder, why would someone be purchasing a military-style assault weapon? There is also just the other question here, which is, okay, let's say someone bought one or two guns in the year. Forget the type for a second. Just say someone bought one or two guns.
Sure.
And gets legal. It was also legal for this guy to, over the course of 1 year, buy 40 guns or 30 guns.
40
guns. Wouldn't that, in the existing background check system, obviously it wouldn't, because this is not even something that we've looked at. We haven't even expanded background checks to close all the loopholes that we've talked about, you know, forever and ever now. I mean, wouldn't you stop to think, why is someone amassing this collection of firearms, many of which are, as we said, used in war?
Look,
and they're not even hunting rifles.
I'll tell you what I heard earlier this week, because when I first came back, I said, take everybody's guns.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's me. Right? That's not Bill. That's me. And Hugh Hewitt. You know this guy, Hugh Hewitt?
Yeah, I know.
Dolt. So he gets...
Cool.
Total goblin. He tweets back at us, oh, well, you know, that's not possible. Who are you going to get to go round up the gun? And then there's this torrent of his mouth-breathing followers. And their argument, honestly, I am not exaggerating. Their argument was, if you try and take everybody's guns, you are inciting civil war. Because those people will shoot whoever comes to try and take their guns. So, like, the argument that I hear from hunters is, well, we have a tradition of hunting in our family, and I'd like to pass that on to my kids. And like, you know what? Cool. I had a tradition of hunting in my family. I have zero desire to pass that tradition on to my kids because we have grocery stores now. We go buy our food at. We don't have to go hunt. But like, okay. All right. If that's your thing, that's your thing. But then these guys are making an argument that they have their guns so they can shoot anybody who comes to try and take them. So what's the point? Because at some point, if we are to get rid of these machine guns and semi-automatic weapons that people have in their lives, if they're like, first of all, I think there's a buyback program that's way more efficient than like going house to house and rounding up people's guns. But like, they're openly admitting and willing to say, we will shoot police officers and armed service members if they come and try and take our guns. That's what they're saying. That's why they want their guns. They're so horny for these guns that they're saying they will shoot either cops or members of the military just so they can keep having them. Now, I don't know that I have a good argument or a defense for that. I'd love to hear it.
Right.
But, like, get rid of your guns. What do you need your guns for?
And I'm sure we'll be asking...
Gotta have 42 guns. What's wrong with you?
We'll be asking this question of Congressman Tim Ryan, who is going to join us in not very long, if you stay tuned to our show, but that's the one thing I do want to point out is a lot of the opponents of, let's say, universal background checks or a ban on high-capacity magazines or assault weapons, they'll say, well, okay, you know, this measure wouldn't have done anything to stop this shooting or this one.
Oh, there's nothing we can do.
Wouldn't do anything.
There's nothing we can do.
And it's not about one shooting. You have to look at the totality.
Yeah.
Because, sure, some people in this may pass a background check and they didn't benefit from a loophole, but that doesn't mean that in the last shooting or the one before that or the one before that, there wasn't a failure of the background check system. If you think about Charleston, another shooting, as we were running through the laundry list, the racially motivated shooting at the Emmanuel AME Church in 2015, the gunman Dylan Roof had benefited from the waiting period being only 72 hours. It was dubbed the so-called Charleston loophole after that.
Yeah.
Where there was a red flag when he walked into a store and attempted to purchase a firearm. And later it turned out that he had a criminal record, mostly related to drug charges, but there were some other incidents too. But It took, obviously, the system more than 72 hours to get back to the dealer. And so once 72 hours had elapsed, that dealer was obligated by the law to sell him his firearm.
I'm reminded of a story that...
And so that's just an example. Like,
yeah, sure.
You know, there's one where you can say, well, actually, if there were some fixes to existing laws, then that could have potentially prevented Charleston. Actually, like some people said the same. I mean, look, I could just run through this laundry list now. They're all coming to me. Navy Yard, the shooting that happened right here. How would you have stopped it? Washington, D.C. has the strictest gun laws. And this guy just went over and got his guns in Virginia, where the laws are more lax. Well, exactly. So now you're actually, ironically, making the case for federal laws as opposed to state level, because you're proving the point that you can't do something state by state. You have to do it at the federal level. And perhaps if there's a federal trafficking statute, if there is a federal background check system that is expanded among other proposals, a ban on assault weapons, a ban on high capacity magazines, then yes, actually a lot of these, not all of them, of course, not all of them, like you said, unless you take away people's guns, but if you passed even one or two modest reforms of the common sense states that you will reduce gun violence.
You could look at every mass shooting in America and you can find some common sense solutions to why that should not have happened. Full stop. I'm reminded of a story that Bill told yesterday. There was a guy who said that he remembers the three deadliest shootings that we've had in this country: Virginia Tech, which was in 2007, Orlando, the Pulse nightclub, which was last year, and then now Las Vegas. And that kid who said that was 22 years old. So, like, in a 10-year span, we have seen the three most horrific shootings we could have possibly imagined, the three most deadly shootings on American soil, and what has happened in those 10 years?
Nothing.
Since. No, not nothing. A relaxation of the gun laws. Like, made it easier for people to get guns.
Actually made it easier.
Like, we should have completely gone the other direction, and we make it easier for mentally ill to get handguns. We're talking
about...
That
is something that Trump just did
a couple
of months ago.
We're about to have more debate on allowing silencers for guns, which nobody needs. Nobody needs.
Actually, you brought up Virginia Tech. That in the same year, there was a mass shooting at Northern Illinois University. It's in the Chicago suburbs in the Aurora area. I was at Northwestern at the time. I was a senior, and I still remember this. Sticks with me that my dad called me, and this is when my parents were still living in Italy, and he was panicked, and he said, "My heart stopped because I just heard, you know, on the news," and he's, you know, in another country. He said, "You know, I heard Northern Illinois, and I just didn't even, you know, I for a moment I thought they said Northwestern, and I had to just pause for a moment and be like, okay, she's at Northwestern. You're a senior, though," because Virginia Tech had just happened too, and he was just getting really worried about these campus shootings. And he said, "I'm so glad you're a senior. Like, at least you're getting out of there soon." And when he said there, he meant college. And I told him, and I remember this conversation so distinctly, I said, "Dad, it doesn't really matter if I'm graduating from college. As long as I live in America, I could get shot anywhere. Yeah. I could be in the office when I get a job. I could be on the metro or on the bus. I could be filling up my gas." I remember when I moved back to the U.S. to start college, there was a sniper incident here in the DMV area. You know, I could be anywhere, really. And I wasn't trying to be so fatalistic, but I was like, you know,
where can you go? What can you do?
I said, it doesn't really matter that I'm graduating from college. That's actually irrelevant. It just so happens that you've heard about a couple of mass shootings at universities, and they were so high profile. And it had been a while since we had had mass shootings at schools. Maybe Columbine had been the last time before that in this really pronounced way.
Schools, workplaces, subway, any other public transportation, on the street, pumping gas. There is nowhere that you are guaranteed to be safe from gun violence. And I just don't believe that that is the price of freedom, as Bill O'Reilly has notoriously said now. That, like, the reason that we have a free society is because we allow crazy people to have guns.
Right.
I just don't buy it. I think we can do something.
We'll pick up this conversation with Congressman Tim Ryan, who will join us after the break. So stay tuned to The Bill Press Show.
Follow us on Twitter at BP Show. This is The Bill Press Show. Live video, Bill's commentary, the best clips from the show, all in one place. YouTube.com/The Bill Press Show.
Welcome back to The Bill Press Show. I'm Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter at The Guardian, filling in for Bill this morning. And joining us now, live in studio, Congressman Tim Ryan, representing Ohio's 13th District, who you could follow on Twitter at Rep. Tim Ryan. Good morning.
Hi.
How are you, Congressman?
I'm good. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. I want to kind of start with Las Vegas just because, you know, I don't want to completely shift tone, and then we can talk about many things that are on your plate. Peter and I were just having a very animated and difficult conversation that we have had so many times right here in the studio. I've been filling in for Bill for years now, and I couldn't even name all the mass shootings that I've sat here and talked about that we've done shows around. This is now the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. Just last year, it was Pulse, the one in Orlando at the nightclub. And you issued a statement. You know, you've called for common sense gun safety measures. And I don't want to sound cynical. I want to ask you, do you have any hope? Because we've had this conversation time and again with no action in Congress.
Not a lot of hope. I mean, I think, unfortunately, with the Republicans in control, I don't think there's going to be any opportunity to do something. I have had some conversations about maybe trying to thread the needle on a couple of these things, at least, you know, move the ball down the field a little bit. But I'm not optimistic about it, unfortunately. But I think, you know, the three or four things we need to do is, you know, obviously universal background check makes complete sense, I think, to most people. You know, the Charleston loophole that we saw what happened down in Charleston, that needs to be closed, where, you know, if we didn't, or the government didn't get to find out within 3 days as to your background, there shouldn't be just a default position where you, okay, go get the gun now. Mm. You know, at CDC, we need to continue to study this as a public health issue. And so I think those are pretty basic things that we should be able to pass. It just obviously at this point.
I want to ask a really quick question. Like, there are some obvious things that I think we can all agree on, right? Like, even some of the GOP agrees that, like, a background check wouldn't be the worst idea. But we're not getting any, I mean, we're not getting some of these things done. Why is that? Is that the influence of the NRA? Is it just a sort of blind holding on to the Second Amendment? I mean, what is it that it can't get us over that hump?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of both. And you got to remember, too, I mean, and this is the answer to many questions today and across the, you know, our political discussions. These Republican districts are so red that their only threat in that district is a Republican primary. Mm. And that means, where's the NRA in the Republican primary? You know, who's pure on issue X, Y, or Z in a Republican primary. And at the end of the day, that drives a lot of people's decision making.
There's been some momentum in these initial days for a ban on bump stocks. That is something that even some Republicans from Ron Johnson, I know in the Senate, to a few others who kind of said that they would potentially look into and weigh, you know, a ban on bump stocks. I think Ron Johnson outright said, and he is the chair of the Senate Homeland Security Committee, I would be for that. You know, he didn't even hedge. So that just to kind of let the audience know that, you know, the bump stocks are what would essentially turn a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic one.
That's what this particular shooter was able to do. If you watch the videos of some of the videos that have come out of the shooting in Las Vegas at the concert, and you see the performers up on stage, and you hear the gunshots, I mean, so many people automatically jumped to that is a machine gun. That is an automatic weapon. I mean, it does not sound like a semi-automatic weapon. And I don't know of any reason at all why you would need that.
Yeah.
Senator Dianne Feinstein has introduced a bill. She did so yesterday on Wednesday that would ban the sale and possession of bump stock equipment. And so, as mentioned, Senator Ron Johnson already saying that he would support it. You know, Senator John Thune, who is in Republican leadership, he suggested that they should look at it. Congressman, where do you stand? Is that something that you believe should be banned?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you aware of any companion bills in the House? Where does this even begin? Because the Senate failed with background checks in the aftermath of Sandy Hook.
So, you know, yes, I think it should. But at the end of the day, I don't think that's going to happen. So what's the next step maybe we can take? Now, if you want to get an automatic weapon, there are a lot of hoops you got to jump through, certifications and paying this and all this stuff. But then you can get this bump stock and essentially turn your gun into an automatic weapon without doing anything. So at the very, 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 very least, you should at least have to do the same things that you would have to do to be able to get an automatic weapon. I'm for the ban. I don't think you need this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just this is the kind of thing that we can address, and it shouldn't be controversial.
Right. The majority of Americans, and this has been proven in polling, support a number of gun safety measures. When you talk about universal background checks, in the aftermath of Newtown, it was 90%. Even if now, with some momentum being lost, it isn't quite that high, the support still stands at roughly 80%. Even majorities of Americans support bans on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. But, you know, Congressman, you're from Ohio, so we're not talking about, you know, New York or California, one of these bastions of liberal ideals. Yeah. You've got a wide range of constituents.
And I hunt.
I lived in Ohio for a little while. I mean, there are a lot of hunters in Ohio, and they use guns to go hunt.
You are from a state that overwhelmingly voted to elect President Trump. Who?
Why do you got
to
remind me about that?
Sorry,
did you bring me here to punish me?
who in the early 2000s, as is the case with a long list of issues, was for all kinds of gun safety measures, including assault weapons ban. He blamed Republicans. He said they won't give an inch. They're owned by the NRA. Of course, somewhat before launching his political career, changed his tune. The NRA was a very early supporter of his campaign, despite his inconsistent record. But when you talk to your constituents, what do you hear from them? Do you hear pushback? And are people not maybe talking about gun safety in the right terms? Is it perhaps even just the way that we talk about it that seems to be interpreted by people as infringing on their rights? Or do you hear support from your constituents?
You know, I haven't heard anything. I've been in D.C. for most of the, Las Vegas situation. I think most people, most hunters in Ohio, are reasonable on this stuff. They're not firebrands necessarily on the issue. They want to hunt. It's a family tradition. It's been passed down through generations. It's one of the most relaxing things they do. I talk to a lot of hunters, and they come back different because they've been sitting in a duck blind and or against a tree turkey hunting, and it's quiet.
Some
and
people
no
have
one,
yoga. Some people have hunting.
Some people. I mean, and it's true. I mean, it's very good for our culture, I think, in Ohio. But I don't think they're against universal background checks. Mm. Of course, you don't want a criminal to get a gun. That's what drives, I think, everybody crazy here. It's like, so you can have a guy get on an airplane and it's okay, or not okay to get on an airplane, but you can get yourself a gun. I mean, those are the kind of things. So I think presented properly, this stuff could pass, and it would be modest steps, and hopefully it would have an impact.
I've got a lot of hunters in my family. I've been around hunters for a while. None of them have semi-automatic weapons to go hunting.
Yeah.
Switching gears a little bit, because it's been an eventful, as usual, 24 hours, but we woke up yesterday to reports that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had privately called the president a moron.
I can't imagine that.
His language was actually reportedly a lot more colorful than I'm allowed to say on air.
Yeah.
This is the Bill Press Show. Come on, anything goes. Give it to us.
But then you had, and I feel like we've exhausted the word unprecedented, but it is unprecedented, and I almost think we shouldn't just now be dismissive of all of the dysfunction, because the rest of the world, and this is the nation's top diplomat, the rest of the world is watching, and they don't think, they haven't just resigned themselves to the chaos as being par for the course, because we had the Secretary of State have to come out and deliver a speech not just reinforcing his commitment to the president, but praising
telling us how smart
record on foreign policy, this very glowing expression of admiration. Congressman, what do you think the rest of the world is thinking right now when they are watching this unfold? That too, from the person who is supposed to be negotiating with other world leaders, or his counterparts who represent other world leaders on our behalf.
I think it makes him look weak. I thought really Tillerson, from reports of CEOs that I know that know him, I don't know him personally, said this pretty stand-up guy, CEO of Exxon. I mean, you think like cowboy boots and hat and pretty tough guy. And then you see him kind of whimpering around Donald Trump and not getting any support from the president. I think international leaders are looking at us saying, boy, it's a lot of dysfunction going on in the United States right now. And here's the thing. It's so critical that we provide leadership right now in the world. I mean, there are so many complicated scenarios now. North Korea is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you look at what China's doing in the South China Sea. Look at Syria. What's going on in the Middle East? What's Iran doing? On and on. We've got a lot of issues. And if the United States isn't leading, things get really screwed up. Mm. And I could use another word there, too. But
something similar something similar to what Rex Tillerson actually
said. Yeah, exactly.
Said.
So that's what bothers me is, like, look, there are consequences to this decision with Donald Trump right now.
I'm going to ask you point blank. Do you think that Rex Tillerson should resign?
No, because I don't know who the hell they'd put in after him.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the thing, like, mostly Democrat, but yeah, he should
be fired.
I mean,
people float Nikki Haley, who is the ambassador to the UN. Some people think that she is sort of acting as the de facto Secretary of State. I guess the question is, do you think that Rex Tillerson is compromised by the events of yesterday? One, the report of the internal feud between him and the president, but then also, I think, proving that he doesn't really have much influence in this administration.
I don't know. I look at Tillerson, I look at Mattis, I look at McMaster, I look at Kelly, and I think, you know, there's those are the adults in the room right now that are preventing something really, really bad from maybe happening. And I you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I do worry anytime I see someone leave the administration, I cringe because I don't know who they're going to put in.
That's a really good point. I mean, look, this is not a problem. This is not a failing of Russia. Right. This is what Donald Trump has done to the State Department and the people who are running the White House with him. You know, like there are multiple offices that have not been filled in the State Department.
Yeah.
Like, they're just recently started doing press briefings for the State Department, which doesn't seem like a big deal to us, but is a really big deal to other countries. That's how they figure out what we're doing. They watch the press briefings and the press conferences. Like that all comes from Trump.
Yep.
And if Rex Tillerson goes, you're right. I don't know who Trump puts in there, but
because anything his Secretary of State says, he would presumably undercut hours later on Twitter or in a speech. I suppose to some extent, doesn't, like you said, there are some people who keep the wheels running or seem to be the adults. Nothing's really going to stop him, the president, I should say, at the end of the day, will it? From undermining his own staff.
Doesn't seem like anything can stop him at this point. I mean, I remind people, he's 70, 71 years old. He's been doing this his whole life.
Yeah.
He's clearly addicted to social media. This is not going to stop. Like, go hunting, find your yoga. Like, because, I think a lot of people are like, I want off the ride.
Yeah.
Like, I just, you know, you've been on those roller coasters. It's like, okay, one too many, hills.
The thing, though? This is his yoga.
Oh, yeah.
This is his hunting.
Wow.
This is what he does to unwind.
Yeah.
The chaos.
Well, it's chaos. It's only been 9 months, and it's been 9 months of chaos. It feels like it's been years.
Boy, you want to kill 5 years? Well, spend 9 months with Donald Trump as president. God, have mercy.
Congressman, I have to ask you, because the more that this sort of chaos unfolds, is this tenable? How long can this last? I mean, you have, you know, a president who is overseeing a period of complete dysfunction. How long do you think that this could last?
I don't know. What could
change?
There's no end in sight. I mean, that's the scary part. And you have people in Congress who weren't willing to exert their constitutional responsibilities as well. And that makes things very, very difficult to contain and surround the president to make sure that he doesn't do anything. But when you have Twitter and you have 30 million followers and the media follows it, you know, with the touch of a button, he can stoke a good deal of chaos, and he has. I don't see it stopping. I would like to say I do, but I just don't see it stopping.
So he's
not going to get impeached. It's just not going to happen. Not while we have this current setup. I mean, the elections next year are going to be a big, big deal. And if we could flip the House or whatever we could do there, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But even still, like, there are people out there that think that the Republicans are going to come to their senses and say, well, we've had enough of Donald Trump. The Republicans are not going to save you.
No.
They're not. They get in line.
They will get in line.
Yeah.
Well, that's a perfect segue, because I was going to ask you about your party's efforts to retake the House, not just the House, the Senate. I mean, you happen to be in the House a few years down the road, the White House, and you are among a group of Democrats who were at a rally in Des Moines on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
You were calling on your party to refocus on the working class. Now, Congressman, you did run for the speakership earlier this year, and you had some disagreements with leadership. Obviously, you know, Nancy Pelosi is still the minority leader. Are you satisfied with the direction that leadership has taken since the election?
I think we're getting there. I think we're clearly talking more about jobs, pensions, the economy more than we were, say, 9-10 months ago. And to me, I think that's an essential message that can help unite us, and I think help us reach out to a lot of the people who did go and vote for Trump or stayed home or voted for some third party candidate instead of Hillary Clinton. They felt like we weren't connecting with them. And really, being in Ohio and being in Iowa, you really see the depth of the disconnect between both parties.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Trump got in. Trump, I mean, ran as a third party candidate. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. He was a Republican, but many Democrats crossed over because they felt like he was a third party candidate. They felt like he was truly independent. And so we're getting there. I think we need a message of growth. You know, we with tax cuts, we've got to talk about, okay, how is this going to help grow the economy? How is this going to help working class people? You know, I'm proposing a $1 trillion expansion of the earned income tax credit, which would be primarily, you know, you give somebody making 75 grand a year with three kids, $12,000. Mm-hmm. Like, those are the kind of, like, really robust, aggressive policies we need to talk about.
Mm-hmm. I should just correct myself. You obviously didn't run for the speakership. I meant to say the leadership.
Yeah.
Speaker Ryan is a different Speaker Ryan.
He won his race, for Leah.
he won his race, but you know, it's I want to ask you though, because you're saying you want a message of growth. I think there is this what's it called, a better deal? Is that the catchphrase?
No. The fact that you don't know is
No, I wanted to make sure, because there's
yes, better deal.
So I said it right. I mean, I just wanted.
No, that's a good point, though. Ask the average American.
Well, the reason I wanted to, because we're also exhausted. Now, granted, I'm a reporter, so I'm living and breathing the news cycle that is largely dictated by the president. If anything, I was going to say part of the difficulty in getting the message across is, how do you break through in the age of Trump? You know, your party obviously wants to hold him accountable. Mm-hmm. You want to call out, you know, decisions he makes with which you disagree, and also, of course, speak to the chaos and show it and hold it up as an example of why you believe that he is failing and that there needs to be turnover and there needs to be change. How do you break through at a time where it's just Trump 24/7?
You know, I think you got to play the long game. I mean, nothing's going to happen overnight where our message is instantaneously going to penetrate the psyche and consciousness of the American voter. It's just not going to happen. We need to build our infrastructure on the ground, door knocking, registering people to vote, having those people active on the ground. And those people are our messengers. And it's eyeball to eyeball. It's on people's front porch. It's on the other side of the screen door. That's how we communicate. And we can't win today. I mean, clearly, Trump voters are still giving Trump a chance. I mean, they're still saying, well, let's wait and see. Maybe this $1 trillion infrastructure package will come. Maybe the coal mines will open up. Maybe the steel mills will open up, all this garbage that he peddled during the election. But at some point, they're going to say, I think this guy was kind of like throwing us some BS.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we have better already laid the groundwork. And I think we're starting to do that. I think we've got some great candidates running. We've got a lot of veterans running. We've got this iron worker running against Paul Ryan.
Iron stash.
We've got a former manufacturing executive running up in Michigan, woman. So we've got some good candidates, I think, that are out there because there's so much interest. And if we're out there talking about the economy, we can do better. We can do better. We can do better. That, to me, is the first couple of steps forward for us, and I think we're starting to take them.
And we can never, ever forget that part of politics. Mm-hmm. Because, frankly, I think we did during the 8 years of Barack Obama as Democrats. I think that, like, we just took our eye off the ball. There was so many times that the Republicans voted to repeal Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
but Democrats just kind of said, we've got Barack Obama as president. It's never going to be repealed. And, like, it's not just about winning the presidency. It's just not.
We didn't frame up the obstruction from the Republicans enough. Mm. You know, the Republicans, Obama had a jobs bill in Congress. He wanted to do more, but he couldn't. He was hamstrung because of the politics and the control of the Republicans in the House and the Senate. But I don't think we did enough to say, look, I want to create jobs. I want to do that X, Y, and Z, and the Republicans are stopping me, and really put the heat on them politically and use the bully pulpit to be able to do that. So, you know, we've got to have, I think, a couple of concrete ideas on how we're going to get people back to work, too. I think we need to talk about, there's 300, I've got a commission that, Bill, that starts a commission to do this. We've got 300,000 federal workers in Washington, D.C. Mm. There's no reason why we can't evaluate that and figure out how do we get 10-15% of those workers out into the countryside. If you could get 30-40,000 federal jobs and put 1,000 in Youngstown, 500 in Dubuque, 500 in Gary, Indiana, you know, and start like putting a tourniquet on these communities. I mean, I don't think most people, even elected officials, Democrats, know the severity of what's happened to some of these communities over the last 40 years. I mean, it is blight, is dilapidation. It's old factories sitting there. It's like, this is baloney. These things in America should come down, all of them. Mm-hmm. And we need to rebuild our communities. And if the federal government can say, okay, you're going to get 500 federal jobs, we're going to build a building, you know, it's going to provide income tax, property tax. There'll be 500 people in your downtown. You could start building a walkable community.
Federal government can do that.
Yeah.
You can do that. The jobs are here.
You can do that.
They're here. They're right here.
On the question of rebuilding communities in a different sense, I want to ask you, I don't want to let you go without asking you, what is Congress doing to help people in Puerto Rico where there's been such devastation? But you people without food, without water, without medicine, has there been any movement?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pressure from us to get the administration. Obviously, the executive branch runs this. You know, the president was down there yesterday or 2 days ago.
He had some paper towels to throw out. So
I feel like I'm back in my fraternity house watching this stuff.
You
know,
awful.
It's like the disconnect between what's going on. I know Democrats stand at the ready to try to help in a lot of different ways. So we'll see. I mean, it's got to be run through the executive and, you know, including using the military.
Yes, I do think that I was saying at the top of the show, we'll probably, in the many images we have from this presidency, that might be one of the prevailing images is Trump.
The Papa shot of him
tossing
paper towels
to people in need.
The terrible strain on the budget. You know.
Oh, yeah, but, yeah, yeah.
I mean,
and if only they had faced a real catastrophe like Katrina.
Yeah.
Well, Congressman Tim Ryan, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We'll be back after the break, so stay tuned to the Bill Press Show.
Good stuff, as always.
This is the Bill Press Show.
Hey, everybody, this is Bill Press. Thanks for listening to the Bill Press and Friends podcast. And now, do yourself a favor. If you haven't already done so, subscribe to the show on iTunes. Here's what you do. Just search for the Bill Press Show. Then you can take us with you and listen in anywhere you go. And you'll get new shows from us as soon as they're posted. And one more thing. If you really enjoy Bill Press and Friends, please help us grow by telling a friend, writing a review, and giving us a rating on iTunes. It's so great to have you on board. Many thanks.
On your radio, on TV, and online, this is The Bill Press Show.
Good morning and welcome back to The Bill Press Show. I'm Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter at The Guardian, filling in for Bill on this Thursday morning, top of the hour. And joining us now in studio is my friend and former colleague, Christina Wilkie, who is a politics reporter for CNBC.com. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on. It's so great to see you here. Obviously, Peter Ogburn is still with us.
Barely.
you know, Christina and
can he make it through the week? Let's see.
Christina and I used to work together at the Huffington Post back when we still called it
the Huffington Post.
And now all the cool kids call it Huff Post. And for some reason, we're letting Igor Babich on the show after you. I don't know what was up with that.
It's a full reunion.
But
wait, really? He's coming in?
I don't know. You know, Jamie did the booking. But yeah, you could obviously...
I don't know if I'm sticking around for that.
You could obviously follow Christina on Twitter at Christina Wilkie and read her great work online at CNBC.com.
Can I just say, by the way, on Twitter, Christina is so good.
Yeah, she's a machine.
Like, she's right there. No, seriously. Like, you're just like a surgeon. You just get exactly what needs to be said.
Thanks, man.
It's really good.
Yeah.
I think my brain functions in 140 characters. It suits me perfectly. Any longer, and I begin to ramble. But
it's like Scoop. Christina Wilkie invented Twitter.
There you go.
Scoop Twitter made Christina Wilkie possible.
Yeah. You know, we've been talking about Rex Tillerson and how crazy it is that he had to come out and give what I have called not too dissimilar from a dear leader type of speech.
Yeah.
And some guy got really upset that I said that on television. It was obviously a Trump supporter who's like, how dare you? You have no idea what you're talking about. I think he basically called me a moron, which is what Tillerson reportedly called Trump behind closed doors. And Christina, one, what does this tell you about Rex Tillerson, his performance on the job, and his relationship with the president?
Well, If I could also say, my colleagues at NBC News also reported, Stephanie Ruhle reported that, that he not only called the president a moron, he called him an effing moron.
Oh, yeah.
Which, when you think about it, works much better as a statement to make.
Yeah.
You know,
like, 100%.
I've never say it in your head.
As a grown-up, I've never called someone a moron.
Right.
I've called plenty of people effing morons.
Exactly.
You know
Weirdly,
what I mean?
I do sometimes call people just morons. Mm. I don't know why that comes.
I don't think I would. And if you, I mean, and then put it into Rex Tillerson's own language and the way that he speaks, and it really becomes much more natural.
So what do you, what kind, what
are you? I have to say really quick, I don't mean to interrupt, but Donald Trump tweeted about this this morning.
Of course he did.
I just want to read that. He says, Rex Tillerson never threatened to resign. This is fake news put out by NBC News. Low news and reporting standards, no verification from me. Which I have to say, that's the best part.
I agree.
No verification from me.
As though the president.
A known liar.
Are we now reaching, it's not like a lot of what he says is true to begin with. But also, are we now reaching out directly to Trump for confirmation?
Not only that, but
is
guess
this a
what?
Thing?
He was never in this conversation to begin with. This was a conversation between NSC members, Pence, and Tillerson.
So
the notion that he would verify a conversation he wasn't a part of.
Okay,
is...
So Trump says, total confidence is sometimes the kiss of death. Do you think that Trump has confidence in Rex Tillerson?
I think Trump doesn't like Rex Tillerson. I don't think they've ever gotten along as individuals. They don't see eye to eye. Rex Tillerson is, as a person, the practically the opposite of Trump. He eschews the spotlight. He does not like to be surrounded by people. He doesn't, he's not a showman. This has frankly made his job and his work as Secretary of State, I think it's injured and undermined his ability to be America's face to the world. Mm. He doesn't like being the public face of much of anything.
He hates this
job, and Trump hates the State Department.
Right.
And put those two things together.
Along with the personal animosity or lack of warm feelings.
Rex Tillerson, in his speech, was asked if he called the president a moron. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I'm not going to deal with petty stuff like that. I mean, this is what I don't understand about Washington. Again, you know, I'm not from this place, but the places I come from, we don't deal with that kind of petty nonsense.
Rex Tillerson has been in front of enough cameras for enough years and done enough press relations that he understands how to deny if you're going to deny, and how not to if you're not going to. So,
that's not a denial.
No.
That's not a denial.
That's
no
all that matters
denial
about that
in
sentence.
That, in his statement.
No,
there's
he just
no denial.
Brushed it off.
Yep.
And then seeking to do cleanup, State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert.
Nauert.
I never knew how to say her name. But she was more adamant that he did not use those words.
The secretary does not use that type of language. The secretary did not use that type of language to speak about the president of the United States. He does not use that language to speak about anyone. So I hope that clarifies it.
It doesn't. I'm sorry. Tillerson had one chance to answer the question.
I mean, that's like... I think
I love
that
these politicians are so pure that they don't use that potty language.
Very much.
That's her doing cleanup everyone said that Twitter blew up. All the reporters are saying no. And obviously all the talking heads immediately said, notice he didn't deny it.
Right. And it was part of a broader cleanup that happened yesterday. So we also had the State Department Communications Director, R.C. Hammond, who also came out. And he had reportedly been part of this conversation during which Tillerson, called the president a moron. But there was a second part of this conversation.
Nikki Haley.
Yes.
Why did Rex Tillerson's spokesman take a clear swipe? But like he had this anecdote that was so clearly designed to undermine Nikki Haley. I mean, the story essentially said that one of these conversations between Pence and Tillerson was pep talks. was so that the Pence could gauge whether Nikki Haley was effective or not in her job, was something to that effect?
It was Pence calling to ask Tillerson whether Tillerson thought that Nikki Haley was effective in her job and whether he thought that she was good for the administration. You don't ask those questions if you know the answers, if the answers are confident. And the fact that R.C. Hammond put this story out there and describe this story to an NBC reporter he's also a career communications pro. So, you know, this is not accidental. He wasn't just relaying a random anecdote. He It's live a well-known.
Tell us about the bad blood here. Is it that Rex Tillerson feels threatened by Nikki Haley because she's ambassador to the UN, but is it because she's seen as this de facto Secretary of State or as the person who would likely take his job? What is the backstory here?
The backstory is that Nikki Haley has made, and her staff have made little secret and private that she would be interested in being Secretary of State. She's also made little secret of the fact that she has broader national political ambitions, which Tillerson, frankly, does not. You know, he's hardly going to be running for office in 5 years. Yeah, I know we also almost chuckle at that idea, yeah. Right?
Right.
But Nikki Haley's in a very different position. She has been long floated, since her earliest days as governor of South Carolina, she's been floated as a potential presidential candidate. She is burnishing her credentials, and she and her staff have a good working relationship with the president. She is seen to have represented the United States well. She goes in front of the cameras. She is telegenic, but behind the scenes, I said this to a colleague. Practically every time Tillerson sneezes, we are informed that if privately he were to step down, Haley would be more than happy to step in.
Yeah, I mean, she left her job as the governor of South Carolina for this job at the UN. That can't be the final stop for
That's
her.
That's not the end game.
That's not the end game. Right.
The president weighed in on this entire controversy, albeit briefly. This was when he was on the ground in Las Vegas.
Total confidence in Rex. I have total confidence.
Well, he just dragged him on Twitter earlier this week saying that, like...
There's one more.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm very honored by his comments. It was fake news. It was a totally phony story. Thank you very much. It was made up. It was made up by NBC. They just made it up.
Very honored. That was kind of surreal. But it was sort of a surreal Trump moment where it seems as though he is getting very different information than the rest of America is. Or that he has decided to believe one thing that is not borne out by the reporting or the facts, and it's as though he only listened to the Dear Leader portion of Tillerson's remarks.
But he is so fixated on how he is covered, how his administration is perceived.
No. I don't think he's all that interested in how his administration is perceived.
I mean, when I say his administration, I mean as a reflection of him.
Yes.
Sure,
you know?
Okay. That's
so
fair.
So how
that's
damaging fair. Is this report for Rex Tillerson? I mean, Trump might say and tweet on the surface, he has confidence, it's fake news, but he holds a grudge. And he's not...
This is exactly the sort of headline. How upset is he?
This is
the sort of headline that the president hates most. It's personal. It's someone undermining him. It is a member of his administration who he believes he has on his cabinet members. He has bestowed upon them the blessing, I think Reince Priebus called it, of working in his administration. He demands absolute loyalty, even though he doesn't always return absolute loyalty. But that is the personal loyalty of his cabinet members to him, and not making him look bad. Is absolutely paramount. And if you think about the way that Mike Pence, kisses up is the term that comes to mind.
Yeah.
But how very, very complimentary is in everything he says. Nikki Haley as well has been always very, very complimentary of the president.
Very effusive.
Yes, effusive. But also, overall burnishing the Trump administration's, whether it's up at the UN, their international credentials, basically, and the notion that the United States is a player on the world stage, that we could put together North Korean sanctions votes, and Tillerson has not done nearly what other cabinet members have.
So what? How long can you envision him lasting in this role?
Earlier this year, there was talk that he might last the year, and that after a year he would step aside. That this wasn't something that he wanted to continue doing. This role, frankly, again, doesn't particularly suit him as a person. He does not appreciate being on the road 300 days a year. He doesn't enjoy the United States travels. The Secretary of State traditionally travels with an enormous diplomatic cadre to these international meetings, and there are optics about this. So the secretary comes with his large American delegation, and And this is, I mean, it is an optics thing where there were the other countries, whether it's the UN General Assembly or meetings in Vienna or in the Middle East, people see this large, united American delegation, and he doesn't like to travel that way. I mean, as my, you know, I have people close to me who work in American diplomacy, and they remind, one of them reminded me that the Secretary Kerry, John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, used to travel with no less than 75 people. Mm. In any time. And Tillerson has made it very clear that he likes to travel with three or four.
So Rex Tillerson, one thing also, is someone who does not
have... That's remarkable.
So Rex Tillerson, one thing I made the point yesterday when this fallout was first coming to the surface, that he doesn't have a lot of allies on Capitol Hill. He was narrowly confirmed, I think 56-43. He received the most number of no votes for any Secretary of State in Senate history. And, you know, you remember, granted, the president has stood by him, but you remember when, for all those months, that the president was laying Jeff Sessions out to dry and just brutally attacking him, and all these Republicans lined up behind Jeff Sessions. The reaction was a little more muted about what Rex Tillerson's future might be, but except for Bob Corker, who was an early supporter of Rex Tillerson. He, of course, is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He just two weeks ago said he will retire. I want to first, we'll get to in a moment, Christine, what you have to say, play his reaction to this controversy over Tillerson.
Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and Chief of Staff Kelly are those people that help separate our country from chaos.
Wow.
Chaos.
That is a low...
Tell us how you really feel, Bob Corker.
Right? Low marks he's giving the administration. Do we have another clip?
No, we just okay. We have a little bit of...
We
have a little bit of a...
Bob Corker was one of the first people who met with Trump after Trump was elected. You remember he went...
Well, he was under consideration.
He was under consideration
for Secretary of State.
Yeah, for Secretary of
State.
And
he's widely considered on the Hill. He has always been considered one of the more reasonable, very well-informed, thoughtful, available senators.
And a very vocal critic of Trump's.
Yes.
And part of why, interestingly, I thought one of the most interesting pieces of his retirement statement was that after a lot of thought, he's decided not to seek re-election, and he thinks that this next period, up until next November, might be the most important period of his public service, which was almost like a warning to Trump. He said something about wanting to have independence,
yeah,
which is like, I'm done. And
right.
I'm out.
Yeah,
and
their backs have got to be killing them from carrying all this water for Trump.
I mean, right. You know, at least one person is willing to just call it quits, throw in the towel, and be like, you know, if he's going to burn it all down, I'm not going
right.
with you. And I will actually speak my mind more. Now I feel like a lot more free. I mean, it shouldn't take not, you know, being up for the election, of course, to have people speak freely. But he's sort of saying, as he did yesterday, you know, that he's going to be more candid. So it's Christina, tell me about Bob Corker and his comments.
Corker unplugged.
This is it's a magic time, I find, when lawmakers announce their retirement, that the time between the time that they actually leave public life and when they announce they're not going to be seeking re-election. Corker was also looking at a potential primary challenge from the right.
Mm-hmm.
So he was looking down the barrel of a very ugly race. Tons of fundraising, a lot of the things, frankly, that are the least pleasant and the worst for your family and just for individual lawmakers to undergo as people. So he was looking at an absolutely miserable couple of years. And he had said when he entered, first was elected to the Senate, that he didn't plan to serve for very long.
And if you have followed Bob Corker at all, as you and I both have, since the election, since prior to the election even, if there's anyone who, when faced with a challenge from the right, is not willing to bear hug Trump,
right?
He's one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, he said after the Charlottesville attack, when Trump blamed both sides, you know, he questioned Trump's stability and capacity to lead. And you could just see that he was just at that point, and it was only a matter of time But other than Corker,
some of those guys
were
forced to go out and defend those comments on Charlottesville.
And what I think is really interesting, in the next 9 months, Corker, I imagine, will probably emerge as one of the voices of the the more middle of the road, reasonable, call them what you will, the Republicans who aren't willing to embrace the president. Mm. Corker, in his case, frankly, because he doesn't have to.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to raise money. He doesn't have to make the party look united. So whereas Corker has certainly acted as a voice, a voice that is pushed back a little bit. I think he'll be a very interesting person to watch in the next 9 months because he's very popular among his caucus. He speaks, I think we can probably expect him to speak on behalf of some senators and other members of the GOP caucus who don't have the liberty.
So publicly.
Yes.
I want to ask you, switching gears somewhat, because you've also been covering Puerto Rico and of course, not nearly enough attention has been given to the devastation caused by the storm there, but also, more importantly, to the lack of urgency in terms of how the government has responded. Now, there has been some response. The officials in Puerto Rico say that it was maybe initially mischaracterized, that they had had no outreach whatsoever from the administration. But can you tell us where things stand, are we seeing an aid package of any kind?
We saw yesterday, we saw the beginnings of an outline from the president, from OMB, of a $23 billion long-term aid package that I believe will be voted on in Congress in mid-November.
Is this just for Puerto Rico?
No, this is Harvey and Florida.
No. They were not going to help Puerto Rico.
No, but this is the real
$23 billion. And how much will be allocated to Puerto Rico? Is it broken down in any way?
No, not yet. This remains to be seen because you have certain programs like flood insurance that need to be shored up significantly, but that you can't necessarily allocate. It's not all immediate debt relief or immediate. Pardon me, immediate hurricane relief and first aid. It's the longer term assurances, whether it's infrastructure rebuilding, but that aren't easily chopped up.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of federal funding, but it will be interesting. I mean, I think we expect it to pass. We expect it to receive wide support from both parties, and it significantly ramps up the amount of money that the federal government will be kicking into these three terrible disasters.
The president was obviously on the ground this week in Puerto Rico, and we were talking about those images where he's tossing the paper towels to people.
Oh.
But he came under criticism for more than just that.
That was just dopey.
Right.
I mean, well, right, but it was tacky, to say the least.
Sure.
But
and tone deaf.
As he had been doing prior to the trip, but he did in person, again, bring up this question of the debt and emphasize fiscal responsibility, which he did not do in Texas, he did not do in Florida. Christina, why does he keep harping on the debt?
Well, this is a very interesting thing, because as he was leaving Puerto Rico, much later at night, he was speaking to Geraldo Rivera, and he said point blank that Puerto Rico's debt will be wiped out. And he was addressing, he said, your friends at Goldman Sachs, I don't know who it is who holds this debt, but they're not going to get repaid, and we're just going to have to wipe it out. And he, yes, so this was this took markets by this shocked markets. It sent Puerto Rican debt bonds, the bond market for Puerto Rican debt, reeling. Puerto Rico has already moved into a sort of a bankruptcy to try to restructure its billions of dollars in debt. And the White House and the administration spent much of yesterday mopping up Trump's comments and making it very clear to bondholders that Puerto Rico's debt would not be, quote, wiped out, that they would still move through legal channels. There's no indication that there is a legal way for the government to simply, basically tell all these bondholders of Puerto Rican debt to shove off. But then if you think about it, it's easy for Trump to say. He liked, at the time he said it, he seemed to like liked the feeling of it. He liked to kind of stick it in the eye of the bankers, was what you got from his tone. And and in his career as a developer, frankly, I think he's never been much of a friend of creditors.
Yeah.
He's carried a lot of debt for a lot of his life.
But isn't it ironic that this person who himself has, you know, had a record of bankruptcy in his business is out here of all times, too, when we're talking about U.S. citizens, mind you, who are just, you know, again, without food, without water, without medication, their homes have been destroyed, people are dying.
First of all, you have to understand that Donald Trump doesn't realize that Puerto Rico is part of the United States.
He's an island.
Surrounded by water.
Big water. Ocean water.
But, you know, there's a sense that he views them as second-class citizens. I mean, you've seen the San Juan mayor really, really go after him. And he attacked her, of course, because he must. He also, while he was there, said they should be proud because they had only had 16 deaths. That's been revised upward to, you know, more than 32. We don't even know the numbers because they hadn't updated the death toll in a week because they have no idea. It's just, it's utter chaos. Why can't he just go there and do what he needs to do?
This comes back to his personality and his inability often to take instruction or cues from his staff. They put him in, frankly, situations that that don't play to his strengths.
Do you think that he views Puerto Ricans as American citizens?
No.
I do. Yeah, you I do. Do. I
no,
do.
No. Okay. There's Absolutely. No way. I don't think so.
Oh.
I don't. I mean, you just look at how he talks about the victims in Puerto Rico versus the ones in
Texas,
or Florida with mm-hmm. Harvey and Irma. Mm-hmm. Like the way that he went there to them and said, "Oh, you should be lucky you didn't get a real catastrophe, like one of those ones that hit us, like Katrina."
But that, I think he was just thinking right then in terms of the death toll. And,
sure.
And yes, it was a foot in mouth, you know, kind of a, not typical, but maybe typical Trump
I'd
comment.
I'd say typical.
I will say that one thing is accurate, that the first time he went to Texas, he was also tone deaf and
right.
Blacked out.
When he,
sure,
when he said, look at that crowd, you know,
right,
thanks for coming out.
And then he had to go back.
Right.
And then he had to roll up his sleeves.
Yep.
And then he had to actually look
and
like,
I think there was,
because Mike Pence showed him up.
Yeah.
Was like carrying
right
the
Pence,
of wood
yeah,
and
the Pence sort of photo op.
This is the dumbest guy.
But there was a moment that I think was underappreciated from his trip to Puerto Rico when he met with some people whose houses had been damaged or destroyed. And that, if I had been his staff, that is the moment that I would have wanted on camera so he can connect with people. He is who he is. He shows no signs of changing. He does not have a very high emotional ability to connect with suffering. But you should have heard, as he was speaking to these people about the rebuilding of their house, he could speak to them as a builder. And he actually did connect.
Sure.
And for like this moment. Yeah.
It was, but I mean, an event like a trip to visit victims of a storm is just a series of moments, whoever the president is.
Man, it's like, can't believe you're saying this about a president visiting storm-ravaged territory, but they should like limit his visit to like 45 minutes.
Literally.
Go see these people
literally.
And get out.
But,
don't sit in the round table.
Don't throw paper goods at them.
Well, don't sit around with local officials and like do a talk about what they need and what your perception is.
Knowing who the president
in and out.
Is, where you Limit take your... him is to speak to people about rebuilding. Where you do not perhaps take him is to a church to hand out aid.
Yeah,
so the,
yeah, yeah.
Neither of those, he's not especially religious, and he doesn't especially connect with people who suffer. So, but that whole situation, if I had been on his staff, I would have said, this is a recipe for a bad photo op, and that's exactly what we got.
You know, I understand the building perspective, and it makes a lot of sense. It's way to identify, but it needs to be said that Donald Trump still has a problem with the other, you know, the concept of the other, okay, mm-hmm. whether it's black people, whether it's Latinos. Any non-whites, really,
yeah.
in most cases, and in a lot of cases, poor people. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump cannot identify with the other.
Absolutely. So if you are if you're working for the White House, you put him in situations with people who he can identify with.
My biggest takeaway from the whole Puerto Rico thing, I know we got a break, but my biggest takeaway was when he went on Twitter and said, these people want something for nothing. Or they want, everything. They want to be taken care of. They want everything taken care of for them. Like, they have no roads, they have no electricity, they have no running water, they don't have food to eat, but they want everything done for them. And, like, to be the president of everybody.
Right.
And to say that.
I mean, at that point, he felt emotionally that he was simply defending himself against criticism.
I know.
Yep.
But I mean, it's just wholly inappropriate.
Yeah.
I think.
Wrong moment, wrong statement.
Sure.
Well, Christina, thank you so much for breaking this all down with us. Fascinating conversation. Really great to see you.
Great to see you
in
too.
Person. I hope your toddler at home gives you a peaceful weekend.
Never gonna
famous
happen.
Last word.
No.
On Twitter, right. Christina Wilkie. She is a
I'll be at the DC Zoo.
She is absolutely a must follow and read her work online at CNBC.com. Stay tuned. We'll be back after this break.
Download our podcast. Search for The Bill Press Show on iTunes. And remember to rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Bill Press Show. Same great show, new great channel. Stream live video at youtube.com/The Bill Press Show.
Welcome back to The Bill Press Show. Sabrina Siddiqui here, political reporter at The Guardian, filling in for Bill on this Thursday morning. I always like to say I save the best for last. Today is obviously an exception because we have Igor Pavlovich in the studio.
Wow.
Thank you. Can I just say I love watching Sabrina and Igor fight. I don't know what it is, but like it's just so entertaining.
Frenemies, I think, is a term I would use for the two of you.
Yeah. Frenemies, that's a good term.
But like best frenemies.
I made that up.
I had
a trademark on that.
Yeah, you did.
I kid. I'm very happy to have Igor here, who is a politics reporter at HuffPost. You all should follow him online at Igor Pavlovich. Read his great work at HuffPost.com. Good morning, Igor.
Morning.
Jokes aside, definitely saving the best for last. We haven't sat here on this show in a long time together.
Have we ever sat here?
I think we have once.
We have?
I don't recall that happening.
I think it was a long time ago. Yeah. I've been doing this for a few years. I feel like there was a moment. But it's been a while since we sat here together, and I'm really glad that you are here for our new segment where we do a pop quiz of events of the week, and I get to rapid fire around you and see what you followed, what you didn't follow.
Cool.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. But we've done this before.
Oh,
and
man,
we did an Igor versus Igor.
Wait, what? I totally made this up.
And you were the superior Igor.
I was hoping to just put him in the hot seat and freak him out.
I got sound effects. Let's do this.
No.
Let's go. I'm ready.
No, I actually just made that up. I didn't realize this is a real thing.
No, we did a segment with
Igor versus Igor.
Igor versus Igor. It was Igor versus Igor.
He who shall not be named, the other Igor.
The other Igor.
Yep. Listen, either we're doing this or we're not doing it. Let's go ahead.
No, we're not actually doing it because I was hoping to mess with him, and it turns out this was a real thing.
This man is ready.
Well, you showed me. But Igor, we've been covering a lot this morning, and the conversation comes full circle with you because earlier we were talking about the aftermath of Las Vegas, and you've been doing a lot of really good reporting on the Hill, where we've had this predictable cycle play out after every mass shooting, and you asked Republicans, it seems, what could be done to stem gun violence? You said you asked them, what can Congress do to prevent mass shootings? What did you hear from Republicans?
I don't knows. A lot of senators have said that it's not the government's priority or power to do that at all. They said that really government should not get involved in regulating guns in any way, shape, or form. A lot of Second Amendment defenders, regardless of the situation, regardless of what kind of device or equipment the gunman used in Vegas, the shooter used this technique that I'm sure you heard about. It's called a bump stock. It's an addition. Mm-hmm. You augment your weapon with it. And it seems like there's a clear path here from what the shooter used to what Congress can take action on, and yet some people in Congress still say there's really no role for government to play here.
I was struck by, Richard Shelby, granted, is senator from Alabama. I mean, that's, of all places, you're not going to expect that to be a source of someone who's going to come around on the issue of stricter gun laws. But He was talking about security at buildings.
Yeah.
Now, I heard this on like Fox News and a few other places. Okay, so now we're going to talk about hotel security. Is that where the conversation might be going as opposed to actual guns?
Right. I mean, hotels are the problem now. We've got to have hotel regulation.
Guns don't kill people. Hotels do.
Like, I remember, I said this the other day. I remember after Sandy Hook, that now sort of infamous speech by Wayne LaPierre, who said...
famous Frenchman.
Yeah, the famous Frenchman, Wayne LaPierre, who also had the National
man.
Rifle Association.
Yeah.
Where he said the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And in the situation of Las Vegas, which is an open carry state,
mm-hmm.
there were plenty of good guys with guns, but what are you going to do when the bad guy with a gun is on the 32nd floor of a hotel 500 yards away? Like, if everybody had realized that that's where the shooting was coming from and they started shooting, that would have been horrific.
Yeah.
And he has bump stocks, which you mentioned.
Right.
Which, you know, as you wrote, they essentially turn a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic one. And there has, however, been some talk, you write, of potentially banning bump stocks even among Republicans.
That's right. You've got a couple of senators saying they want to look at the issue more. They honestly, a lot of these senators and congressmen really are not familiar with the issue of bump stocks. I was new to it. You know, not a lot of people really knew about it.
Yeah.
So they're still looking at it, and it's notable that they're at least willing to consider it. You've got Ron Johnson in Wisconsin saying he could be in favor of banning it. You've got Senator Dianne Feinstein of California introducing a ban. So we'll see if it goes anywhere.
I honestly hadn't heard of this before this story. Yeah. What's the defense of having bump stocks out there for just regular Americans to have?
So there isn't really a defense of having them. A lot of people who are fierce Second Amendment defenders say that they're already illegal. And that even without one, you could still simulate automatic fire in the way you shift your stance and the way you pull the trigger. But then you get into the argument.
That's
of,
not comforting, by the way.
Right.
Right. That doesn't make me feel any better. About
right. But that's
where we
kind
stand.
Of like a huge cell phone, because
sure.
then you're saying, like, why have semi-automatics
right.
if anybody could shift their stance and you know,
make it automatic.
Right.
Yeah.
So Senator Dianne Feinstein, of course, Democrat from California, she did introduce a bill that would ban so-called bump stocks. And here is what she had to say.
Our bill is simple and straightforward. Ban manufacturing or possession of accessories that accelerate a semi-automatic rifle's rate of fire to that of an automatic.
Now, you had people like even David Perdue, Republican from Georgia, saying you can't buy a chain-fed machine gun in the United States today. There's a reason for that, and I want to make sure nobody has access to that if that's the law of the land. Senator John Thune, who's in leadership, said it's something we need to take a look at. And you, as you know, Ron Johnson, he was much more forthcoming. He said, I have no problem banning those. But I do recall after Sandy Hook,
mm-hmm.
You know, and you were covering politics then, too. And we all covered that debate where initially you had these Republicans who came with this sense of purpose that, okay, 20 children have been massacred and 6 educators. And I mean, these kids were ages 6 and 7. And there was this sort of resolve to do something.
Even the NRA came out and said we'd be willing to look at background checks.
They said we'd be willing to look at background checks initially. And that's how, and you because it was not just a liberal reaction, you had something like Manchin Toomey, where you had Pat Toomey, who was a Republican facing a tough reelection in Pennsylvania, along with one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress, in Joe Manchin. But then
people sort of forgot.
A few months of mounting opposition from the gun lobby killed the background checks bill from even passing the Senate, let alone ever being cleared in the House. So when you kind of hear this about bump stocks, do you feel like there might be something different here? Or is this just, again, the immediate reaction to the shooting? And, you know, we might have a debate, we might not.
It's hard not to be cynical, because we've sadly seen so many of the situations play out the same way. And the push for new gun control legislation is so tough on the Hill, especially with both Republican-controlled houses of Congress. What could make it somewhat easier this time is if Donald Trump comes out and says, this is something I want to do. This is something I'm going to direct my, you know, ATF to regulate or even in some way back it. Because you've got a couple of senators now saying they'd be willing to go there. Him coming out and saying this would push it over.
And we were talking earlier about how, as with a lot of other issues, you know, 2000, the year 2000 version of Donald Trump was out there criticizing Republicans for being under the grip of the NRA, proposing or criticizing them.
I'd love for someone to ask him about that.
Criticizing
just to see how he gets
for
out
not
of that.
Supporting criticizing Republicans at the time for not supporting a ban on assault weapons. And I mean that, you know, he once supported comprehensive immigration reform. You've got all these issues, of course, where he has been inconsistent, to say the least. Yeah. So I think there was a prevailing question as to which version of Trump would we get after Las Vegas. This is the biggest, you know, mass shooting that has taken place since he took office. Now, you know, it's amazing how there's been plenty of others since he took office. We just don't talk about them.
Yeah.
If it's the point now where it's like, if it's 5 to 8 people, we're like, meh.
Yeah. That's not so bad.
I mean, that's kind of where we are.
Yeah. What's different now is the high death count.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this is now the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. And it's remarkable because it was just last fall when it was Orlando, and that was about 48 people, I believe. And
I also think the optics of this one, of being in Las Vegas, and there's so much video of it,
right?
And like
Trump himself has his casino in Las Vegas.
He has a casino there, yeah. And like the Mandalay Bay is one of the more well-known resorts there in Las Vegas. Just to see that thing with the busted-out windows, it's like
what gives me hope this time that they might do some kind of marginal thing like bump stocks, is that in this case you have something clear that was on the scene. This guy used this bump stock on 12 firearms.
Yeah.
You know, he had 12, in just in case one overheated, he had another one. You know, like this was well thought out.
Yeah.
And you have something clear here that Congress can take an action on and ban it. In prior cases, Sandy Hook, for example, Congress pushed for background checks. Republicans said background checks wouldn't have stopped Adam Lanza because he used his mother's weapons.
So those firearms.
There's a clear action, you know, reaction kind of. It's not tangential in this case,
right? Right. It's not one of those where they could say that, you've noted. This law wouldn't have even prevented this particular massacre, even though, you know, they always look at it on these one-off cases, and then, of course, there's plenty of other shootings that could be prevented by background checks.
I'm a squishy liberal a little bit on this, but if there's a law that says you can't have 42 guns in your possession, I'm for it.
Yeah, well, that's a remarkable
what do you
thing.
Need 42
is
guns
that he
for?
Bought?
What would he
he
do
bought
with
the
that?
Majority of these guns, almost all of them, in the course of 1 year.
Yeah,
and so. It's that if you're looking at the background check system, one would think that there would be some sort of flag
on
when someone is amassing. Yeah.
But he bought some of those guns from a store called Guns and Guitars. Yeah. So that tells you all you need to know.
They may have been guitars.
It's also one thing that is just worth noting for our listeners is that Nevada, incidentally, was in some ways the ground zero of the gun control debate leading up to this shooting, because voters in the state of Nevada in 2016 did approve narrowly a measure by ballot initiative to expand background checks, to expand them to private sales, including transfers between families. And the Republican-led state, I should say the Republican officials in the state, have barred that from being implemented, even though it was actually a ballot referendum.
Right.
So it would be interesting to see if the lieutenant governor and the very popular governor, Brian Sandoval, if they change course now, at least on implementing what their own voters, what their own constituents had clearly decided they were comfortable with. One thing that we always talk about in the moments like these is if it's something... if the shooter is Muslim, as was the case in the aftermath of Pulse, Trump is more than willing to come up with immediate proposals such as banning people from coming into the country.
Yeah.
You know, in this case, of course, don't talk about banning guns or anything like that. But if someone happens to be Muslim, then okay, well, the answer from him was, as we know, to ban. And after San Bernardino, that was when you saw the Muslim ban to begin with.
Yeah, I wonder if he would have called again for a new Muslim ban.
If the perpetrator had been Muslim. And you wrote another story that is about how his travel ban does nothing to stop the most deadly form of terror in the U.S. Tell us a little bit about your piece, what you found.
Well, it in light of Las Vegas and the horrific massacre there, it seemed to me the reasoning for a travel ban was a little absurd, given the fact that mass shootings in the United States kill so many more people than what he's looking to solve, mass terror attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a person from Chad didn't shoot up a country music festival.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody born here, somebody living here. So the Trump administration's rationale for this travel ban just seemed so frivolous to me, given the shooting, and I wanted to make that point.
You point out that between 1975 and 2015, foreign-born terrorists, including immigrants and tourists, killed a total of 3,024 people on U.S. soil. That was according to a Cato Institute report in 2016. By contrast, more than 30,000 people in the U.S. are killed by firearms each year. But you also
30,000 people every year.
Yeah.
30,000 American citizens are murdered or killed by guns every single year.
A good number of that are suicides,
sure,
by the way.
Sure.
And in that total,
so broken. We are just so broken.
And in that 40-year period where you discussed foreign-born terrorists, it also was worth noting of those 3,024 deaths, all but 41, as you wrote, came on 9/11.
I was going to say,
we're talking about one, you know, massive incident.
Right.
But as in a bigger sense, this country has been very successful at circumventing acts of terrorism. But you also write that mass shootings don't constitute an act of terror. Why is that?
Legally, under the federal law, it's hard to prove in court that there was intent legally that somebody wanted to commit an act of terror. Now, in all effect, we all know a mass shooting does instill terror in a population.
Look at the video from Las Vegas. I mean, those people were terrorized.
Right.
And so it seems to be operating off of a political motive, right? Like this
That's right.
Like a political or religious agenda that was behind a shooting. In Las Vegas, we still don't have a motive.
Just disturbing.
It's just disturbing. And someone who, by the more that they paint a picture, seem to have this, you know, secret life, is what police have said.
It's so interesting. It's so interesting to me that we keep looking for why this happened or what his motive was, and I think that that's natural for us to do as a society. But like, the more we look at it, the less answers we're getting.
Yeah.
And that is horrifying. That's way more horrifying than like, oh, this guy was mentally ill and had a, you know, axe to bear against this particular sect of people or this particular crowd, which is a lot of times what we end up seeing. But like, the fact that it's so, like, there's nothing.
Yeah. What disturbs me most
is, he did it because he could.
Yeah, is, you know, you have various news outlets going to places where he would frequent, you know, casinos or his local coffee shop, and everybody is just saying, what a kind guy, you know, like, what a
That's
nice
amazing.
Guy. And I'm like, I can't.
It doesn't make it any easier, but it also, it makes it way more scary to me. I mean, that like, you know that there are other people out there that could,
that are watching news coverage of this.
Yeah.
You know?
This could happen to anybody, anywhere, at any time. That's my takeaway.
And as we pointed out earlier in the show, but bears repeating, a couple months ago, Trump made it easier for the mentally ill to gain access to firearms. Now, Obama had signed a handful of executive actions with very limited, capacity, in the very limited capacity he had to try and enforce more regulation in terms of background checks for those who are mentally ill, you know, tightening some of the ways in which it's defined. And then those, of course, were tossed out.
They were rescinded
by Trump. We're also, you know, I think we're following this story. We're seeing it unfold. His girlfriend, as I know at the top of the show, weighed in yesterday. She said she had no idea. Now, obviously, she's speaking through a lawyer. One would imagine she's trying to, she needs to take whatever measures she can to protect herself. Although it seems that he dispatched her to the Philippines, wired her a lot of money, didn't really explain, and here you are.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, we'll be following the story here on the show and all of the developments. Igor, another thing we were talking about this morning, and it's just so bizarre. This Tillerson calling Trump
Brexit.
Brexit. I'm taking bets. How long do you think he lasts in his job?
Well, it seems like everybody in the White House kind of wants him gone, and I'm suspicious about this story. I don't want to say I'm a truther about this whole thing.
Sure. Okay, fake news.
Well, you've got obviously some people outed him for saying this thing. This meeting took place months ago, and I wonder if this didn't get planted in the press to push this guy out because, you know, he's just so unwanted there.
An ally of...
Jamie Benson also a Rexit Tillerson truther?
I approve of that theory.
One would assume he would be smarter than to have said this in the presence of Nikki Haley or one of her allies.
I see
Why would he say... You know, it's remarkable.
I see
that,
but I also think that someone thinking that Donald Trump is an effing moron is the most believable story I've ever heard.
Oh, totally. Oh, he said it. There's no question.
Right.
And he's not the only one who has said it.
Right.
I have to quickly, because I want to mention this story before you go, that embattled Republican Tim Murphy is going to retire. This is the guy who is a staunch opponent of access to abortion. And of course, we learn that he asked his mistress to terminate a pregnancy. This is why people hate Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this story is just the epitome of why people think that these guys are so hypocritical, cynical, that they have no actual beliefs.
You could say that his career was aborted.
Sorry, no points for that.
He's here all week, guys.
No, look, I mean, you look at any of these people who are pushing for moral legislation.
He voted for a 20-week abortion ban on Tuesday. He's a member of the House Pro-Life Caucus.
Look at these guys and then look at their personal lives. I guarantee you there's something.
Who was the other guy who did this? Scott
Desjardins.
Man, Mike McAuliffe was
still in Congress, by the way.
He's still in Congress. Mike McAuliffe, who was at HuffPost previously, was just so good on this story. He was like the Scott Desjardins beat reporter. But like this is not. I mean, you've seen this a few times.
Yeah, my favorite part about this story about Congressman Tim Murphy was him telling people, "Oh, you know, these tweets and everything that I've put out pro-abortion, that wasn't for me. That was just my staff. Just blame it on the staff."
Oh my God.
Well, we've heard that one before too. You should have saved your punchline. His career was aborted for this moment right here. Igor Bobich, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Don't forget to follow him on Twitter at Igor Bobich. Read him at HuffPost.com. And tune in tomorrow. We'll be back at the Bill Press Show. Great to be with you this morning.
This is the Bill Press Show.